Hello, and welcome to the Campus Bible Study podcast. Campus Bible Study is the Christian University group based at the University of New South Wales. We seek to prayerfully proclaim the crucified Christ as Lord of all, and hope that these weekly podcasts are an edifying encouragement to you, wherever you are tuning in from.
So the passage is Matthew chapter 27, verse 27 to 56, starting from verse 27. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters, and they gathered a whole battalion before him. And they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. And twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and put a reed in his right hand. And kneeling before him, they mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they spit on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him off the robe and put his own clothes on him, and led him away to crucify him. As they went out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. They compelled this man to carry his cross. And when they came to a place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull, they offered him wine to drink, mixed with gall. But when he tasted it, he would not drink it. And when they had crucified him, they divided his garments among them by casting lots. Then they sat down and kept watch over him there. And over his head they put the charge against him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Then the two robbers who were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left, and those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes and elders mocked him, saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now, if he desires him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" And the robbers who were there with him, crucified with him, also reviled him in the same way. Now from the sixth hour, there was darkness over all the land until the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, "Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani," that is, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some of the bystanders hearing it said, "This man is calling Elijah." And one of them at once ran and took a sponge filled with sour wine and put on a reed and gave it to him to drink. But the others said, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to save him." And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And the earth shook and the rocks were split. The tombs were opened and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. When the centurion and those who were with him, keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake and what took place, they were filled with awe and said, "Truly, this was the Son of God." There were also many women there, looking on from a distance, who had followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him, among whom were Mary Magdalene, and Mary, the mother of James, and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee.
Heavenly Father, we thank you that you are the one who speaks, that you reveals what is true and necessary for our life. Father, may we understand your Son's death, that we may respond to you rightly. We ask this for Jesus' sake. Amen. By around 9 a.m. on Friday, the 3rd of April in the year AD 33, the son of a carpenter turned itinerant preacher was nailed to a cross outside Jerusalem and left to die. Things had moved quickly that morning. The entire case for his execution was only brought before Pilate, the Roman governor, that morning. And yet, the trial had finished. He'd been flogged by the soldiers. He'd been dressed up and mocked as a so-called king. He'd been then paraded about 500 metres out of town, perhaps too weak to even carry his own cross. A passerby was compelled to carry the bit of wood out to the site. He was stripped naked, nailed to the cross, and hung to die. All before 9 a.m. on a Friday morning. If you'd been there, your eyes would probably have been drawn to the horror of the scene. But you probably also wanted to look away for the brutality and the gruesomeness of what you saw. And yet what you would have witnessed, even though it looked weak, shameful, defeated, this hastily arranged execution was no less than the most significant event in the entire history of the world. This was the death of Jesus of Nazareth. But how is that possible? Surely all expectations are that hope should die with the hero. This is what the leaders expected. Jesus had quite a following, he had quite an influence. But they thought that surely as he is put to death, no one would still follow him. It would all come to nothing. And yet Matthew tells a different story. His eyewitness historical account is all about showing why Jesus' death delivers hope rather than destroys it. This was the event that was plotted to cancel Jesus. And yet Matthew wants us to see it's the actual confirmation of all that Jesus is and has said. For a start, we've seen time and again through Matthew's account that Jesus said he must die. In chapter 16, he said he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. Again in chapter 17, similarly, Jesus said the Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men and they will kill him and he'll be raised on the third day. Then in chapter 20, there's even more detail. He says, see, we're going to Jerusalem. The Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes. They'll condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. And he'll be raised on the third day. Jesus said it's going to happen again and again. And as we read this chapter, it's exactly what happens. They've arrived in Jerusalem. The night before, we read it last week in chapter 26, Judas delivered Jesus over to the chief priests and the scribes. In their rush trial that happened overnight, they condemned Jesus to death. And now, early in the morning, what do? They delivered Jesus over to the Gentiles, to the Roman ruler, Pontius Pilate. And what happened next? Well, he was mocked, he was flogged, and he was crucified. Jesus' death was no accident. It took place exactly as Jesus had said it would. It was the proof that affirmed who he was and what he came to do. And so Matthew recounts this event, highlighting for us its truth, its significance, that we would not walk from Jesus, but be drawn to him. And one of the ways he does that is through tragic irony. So we're at point two in your outlines. Irony, the English people tell me, is when you see something happen or hear something that is the opposite of what you would expect. A bit like a policeman being caught for shoplifting, or the English teacher who can't spell dictionary, or maybe it's the doctor who doesn't like helping people. But maybe that's too close to the truth. But it's the opposite of what we expect. And so when we experience irony, it grabs our attention. It focuses us on something that we should be noticing that doesn't seem quite right. It's like a literary highlighter. And throughout this chapter, Matthew has got that highlighter going everywhere. The irony is one of the powerful ways that Matthew helps us to see the truth and the significance of what is taking place. You see, in the 26 chapters before this, Matthew's primed us, Jesus has shown us through his words, through his teaching, through his character, through the fulfillment of scriptures, who he is and what he's come to do. And yet this chapter seems to turn it all on its head. And yet those ironic words remind us that all we have seen is true. For a start, there's the innocence. The obvious assumption when someone is tried and condemned and even executed is that they're guilty. And that's what courts and judges and the justice system is all about. And yet Matthew highlights the awful irony that Jesus was innocent and righteous, yet condemned to death. First, there's Judas. He was the one who betrayed Jesus, one of his own disciples. And you may wonder if he came to some understanding, some insight that meant that he handed Jesus over. Tragically, the only insight he comes to is his own guilt. Have a look down at verse 3. When Judas, Jesus' betrayer, saw that Jesus was condemned, he changed his mind and brought back the 30 pieces of silver, saying to the chief priests and the elders, "I have sinned by betraying innocent blood." You see, Judas affirms that Jesus is innocent. Rather than finding some dirt on Jesus, he's convinced that he's covered in dirt for his own sinful actions. And tragically, the priests who are there to help the people deal with their sin, they offer no hope or help to Judas. He tries to set things right simply by throwing the money back to them, but he's plagued by his own guilt and takes his own life. It is a truly tragic and confronting endorsement of Jesus' innocence. The religious leaders then bring Jesus before the Roman governor, Pilate. They didn't have authority to kill Jesus, and so they need Pilate's help. And so they bring what they feel is a political charge that will motivate his execution. Here is the one who is the king of the Jews. But Pilate sees no guilt or threat in Jesus. Rather, in verse 18, Pilate perceives it was out of envy that they delivered him up. And so he tries to appeal to the crowd that whether they might want him to release Jesus to them. While he's waiting the answer from the crowd, word comes from Pilate's wife. It seems that she's had divine revelation in a dream about Jesus' innocence. Look at verse 19. Besides, while Pilate was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him, "Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for I have suffered much because of him today in a dream." But then we come to the crowd. They've been persuaded by the religious leaders that Jesus is the one who should be condemned and some other criminal or rebel is the one who should be released. Pilate protests in verse 23, "Why? What evil has he done?" But the crowd aren't interested. They just crow for his crucifixion. And so ironically, Pilate delivers Jesus to be crucified, knowing that Jesus is innocent, and somehow trying to claim that he too should be innocent of the blood of the man he condemns. In verse 24, when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took water and washes his hands before the crowd, saying, "I am innocent of this man's blood." And the general assumption is that only a guilty man would be condemned to die, but both the Jewish religious leaders and the Roman governor have condemned an innocent man to death. And then Jesus was mocked. We're struck by the mockery of the religious leaders last week in chapter 26. Here it continues with the soldiers, then the passers-by, then the religious leaders, then even the rebels on either side of him dying with him. They all mock and ridicule Jesus. But why mockery? I wonder if mockery is generally driven by both envy and insecurity. Who do we mock? Those who might have one up on us. Maybe they're smarter or better looking or more popular or more influential. So we mock them to try and bring them down because we're insecure in ourselves. But sometimes that insecurity is so great that we look at people who we think are less than us and they're an easy target to mock to try and prop ourselves up. Mockery seems to be driven by insecurity and envy. It often says more about those who hurl the words and the insults than the ones being mocked. And yet, ironically, the words of mockery throughout this chapter speak the truth about Jesus. They remind us of who he truly is. So why don't you have a little moment to skim through the chapter? We're doing a little bit of skimming today to look at what's been going on. How is Jesus mocked? Have a quick look through. What are some of the truths that are said even by people who don't believe them? Take 30 seconds, say hi to those around you. All right, let's come back together. How is Jesus mocked? What are some of the different things you notice in the passage? Who wants to call some of them out? They place a crown of thorns on him. The soldiers kind of dress him up as a mock king with a crown of thorns, a reed in his hand, a coat on his shoulders. They ridicule the idea that this guy could be a ruler. Thanks, Eric. Other things?
On top of that, we were kind of chatting about how the king role that they give him, it's a king who suffers, which is ironically not that far away from the sort of king that he is as a suffering servant.
So there's this picture that they think it's ridiculous that the king would suffer, and that's exactly who he is. Thanks, Lockie. Other things?
He gets mocked on the way to Golgotha, so by the passers-by, by the elders, by the teachers of the law, as he walks by.
Yeah, or maybe it's even on the cross, these people walking past hurl these insults. I'm not sure if you noticed some of the different words they say. In verse 40, the passers-by, they wag their heads. You who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you're the Son of God, come down from the cross. It's the accusation that was brought before Jesus at his trial, that he would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. And yet, as they mock him, that's exactly what's happening. As Jesus said beforehand in chapter 24, the great abomination of desolation, when God's temple is desecrated, is taking place as God's own Son is mocked and crucified. This is the sacrifice that brings an end to all sacrifices. Their words of scorn are the very fulfillment that they fail to see. At Jesus' death, highlighting that fulfillment further, what happens? The temple curtain is torn in two from top to bottom. The temple is no longer the place where you go to meet God, to be right with God. This was the sign that the days of temple worship had come to an end. And ironically, in those words of mockery, when they say to Jesus, if you're the Son of God, come down from the cross, they echo the words of Satan as he tempted Jesus back in Matthew chapter 4. If you're the Son of God, do this. Satan and his words are not the company that you want to keep. What are some of the other words of mockery that we notice in the chapter? We've got the passers-by, the temple accusation, the crowd. Anything else you noticed?
Well, like the other people on the cross
with you. Yeah, even the criminals. It's pretty low act, isn't it? You know, these guys who are condemned rightly are mocking the innocent guy. The religious leaders, they also get on the action in verse 42. I'm not sure if you noticed, he said, salvation's their theme. He saved others, but he cannot save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross and we'll believe him. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now, if he desires him. For he said, I am the Son of God. You see, right back in chapter 1, we'd been told, God had announced that Jesus would be the one to save his people from their sins. That was his mission. Years later, about 30 years later, Jesus actually said that his purpose was to come and to give his life as a ransom for many. The way to save his people from their sins was his innocent life being substituted for their death. And then just last week, we saw Jesus explaining the night before he died, as he celebrated the Passover, that his blood had to be poured out to bring in this new covenant, this new way that God would relate with people, where the forgiveness of sins was possible. Jesus' mission was to save, and he saved others by not saving himself. This is how God's King rescues his people, how he gathers them into his kingdom, how he is established on his royal throne. Ironically, their mockery reminds us of Jesus' claim that his death was for salvation. Do you see again and again how through this chapter, Matthew twists things around? He uses the irony of the situation to highlight the truth of what is taking place. Though tragic, this was the death of an innocent man in fulfillment of God's plan as the King of the Jews bringing the destruction of the temple so that his people could be saved and enjoy a relationship with him. Irony is pretty important in this chapter, but there's lots of other ways through the chapter that Matthew actually draws our attention to what we need to know. So we're at point three over the page, death, destruction, and divinity. For a start, did you notice all the different factual details in this chapter? Matthew recounts heaps of names and places and events and even times. It's not a fable or a fiction. These are things that happened in history that can be explored and trusted. You know that if someone tells you a story that seems a bit dodgy, you ask some more questions, don't you? Who else was there? What was it like? Tell me, what do they say? You want more details in the hope that it's going to expose that the question or the story is just a fake. But here, Matthew, knowing that, he gives us all the details so we can know that this truly happened in history with these peoples in these times and places. In verse 2, we're introduced to Pilate. He's the Roman governor in Jerusalem, and history tells us his title in the Roman world was the Prefect of Judea, and he ruled from AD 26 to 36. Then we're told about Judas, who threw the money back into the temple. Ironically, the priests were happy to pay for his betrayal, but then they consider that this money is dirty money, is blood money. And so they can't go into the temple treasury. I'm not sure what it says about them being servants in the temple, but anyway, the money can't go into the temple treasury, so they buy a field that's called the Field of Blood, verse 7, still to this day. So you can go and check it out if you're living there at the time. Matthew then talks about where different places, different things take place. It's in the temple, it's the governor's headquarters, it's out at Golgotha, also known as the place of a skull. On the way, there's this bloke, Simon of Cyrene, who's compelled to carry Jesus' cross. As Jesus is crucified, there's two others who were in prison, then are executed alongside him. Matthew then gives us some times and some signs. In verse 45, we're told that there's darkness all over the land from the sixth hour to the ninth hour. That's from the middle of day to 3 p.m. The Jews started counting from 6 a.m. in the morning. And then at 3 p.m., that temple curtain is torn in two. There's an earthquake. Even some of God's people had been previously dead are raised alive and actually seen by people after Jesus' resurrection in Jerusalem. There's all these things that you could explore, that you could validate, that you could check. It hasn't happened in a back corner somewhere. And then at Jesus' death, we're told about the Roman centurion who was guarding and overseeing Jesus' execution. Standing further back, there's other witnesses. In verse 55, we're told about the many women who were looking on from a distance, women who'd followed Jesus from Galilee, that served him, they know him intimately. And among them were Mary Magdalene, and Mary the mother of James, and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. They watched as Jesus was crucified and mocked and died. They were still watching in verse 57 as a wealthy man called Joseph, who came from the town of Arimathea, he asked Pilate for the body of Jesus, wrapped it in linen and buried it. In verse 60, Joseph places Jesus in his tomb. In verse 61, who's still there? Mary Magdalene, the other Mary, sitting opposite the tomb. You see, Matthew wants us to know again and again that Jesus truly died. These people saw it. These people did it. These are facts of history. But why is that so important? You'd expect that the resurrection would be the thing where you need to draw all the evidence to really prove. But Matthew spends a lot more time on the historical evidence around Jesus' death. Why is that? Well, why don't you have a quick chat with those around you? Why is it so important that Jesus really died? 30 seconds, see what you think. All right, let's come back together. Why is it important that Jesus really died? Well, for a start, as we saw, because he said he would. He was really explicit about what would happen, and if it doesn't happen, you should question him, right? Is this a guy that you can trust? But because it happened exactly as he said, gives us confidence that here is a man who's trustworthy, who's reliable, who even seems to know the future, perhaps even determine the future. More than that, as we also saw, Jesus' death was essential because it was how he could bring salvation. It's how he could accomplish his purpose for coming into the world. The innocent dying for the guilty to bring forgiveness of sins. There's no other way that we could have a relationship with God, peace with God, hope with God, if Jesus didn't actually die as he said. And on top of that, God had promised an eternal and ultimate kingdom ruled by a man. Now all people die. And so death had to be overcome in order for this kingdom to be established. And Jesus was proclaimed as this Christ, the Son of God, the ruler of his kingdom. And yet if he didn't really die, was he truly raised? Was the resurrection any conquering of death? Was it really the dawn of this new kingdom? To establish that Jesus truly died is so foundational to all of his claims that the resurrection flows as, in a sense, the logical conclusion. But more of that next week. And that's actually really important for us to grasp and to hold on to the truth and the reality of Jesus' death and the necessity of his death, because some people question it. About 600 years after Jesus died, a new teaching appeared that tried to deny that Jesus really died, both theologically and historically. Muslims believe that God revealed the words of the Quran to one of their prophets called Muhammad over a period of about 23 years. In one of the chapters of the Quran, in Surah An-Nisa, in response to the claim that people killed the Messiah, the Quran very explicitly says, "But they neither killed nor crucified him. It was only made to appear so. Even those who argue for this crucifixion are in doubt. They have no knowledge whatsoever, only making assumptions. They certainly did not kill him." And that's clear. Both of these texts cannot come from God and speak the truth, can they? But more than 600 years before this was written, Matthew said he was there, and he provides the eyewitness historical account of Jesus' death so we can have confidence that this truly did take place, validating Jesus' words, bringing in Jesus' kingdom, and achieving the forgiveness and the salvation that are so central to God's eternal plans. But even as we see really clear that Jesus died as God had promised, as the saving king that he was bringing in, we may still have some questions about the details. In verse 45, there's this darkness over the land for 3 hours, the middle of the day. There's an earthquake in verse 51 when Jesus dies. As the darkness lifts, Matthew records these as historical facts. But what should we understand from them? What should we infer from them? A good place to start would be to look within Matthew. If he wants us to understand the significance of something, he's probably told us. Or if not, he assumes that we'll probably find it within the scriptures that we may have access to. And I think we find the clues from a couple of weeks ago in chapter 24. Things we looked at a few weeks back, but Jesus only spoke a few days back as he taught his disciples in response to their question about the destruction of the temple and the end of the age and his coming in his kingdom. Jesus said that there would be earthquakes. He said that the sun would be darkened. And these events kind of show a cosmic or a creational significance to the events that were taking place. This wasn't just the death of another man. This was attack on the very creator and sustainer of the universe. And the creation shudders and responds in response. Seeing all this take place, did you notice what the Roman guards conclude? In verse 54, the centurion and those who were with him keeping watch over Jesus, they saw the earthquake and what took place, and they were filled with awe, and they said, truly, this was the Son of God. Presumably, they'd been part of the gathering in Pilate's headquarters where they'd mocked Jesus, dressing him up as a king. They thought it was a ridiculous claim. And then, maybe 6 hours later, they're there as he dies, having heard the words and seen the signs, and they come to a radically different conclusion. Here are people who seemingly had little, if any, knowledge of the Jewish scriptures. They seem far from God. And yet here they have a greater insight than those who claim to study and teach and represent the word of the living God. It's a striking picture that God can open anyone's eyes to the truth, even those responsible for executing his son. But what's going on with Jesus' cry on the cross? In verse 46, in the darkness, Jesus famously cries out, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. It's the Aramaic of the first line of Psalm 22. We're told it means, my God, why have you forsaken me? Now, these are the only words that Matthew records Jesus saying on the cross. Surely they have great weight and great significance. But what does Jesus want us to understand from these words? Many people infer that Jesus is describing a separation from God, suggesting that he's somehow cut off from his eternal Father as he experiences God's wrath for the sin of the world. However, to say that at this point Jesus somehow ceases to be God, or that God is somehow divided, I'm not sure if you've got two gods then or what's going on, that's a pretty big theological claim. And I want to suggest from rather scant and speculative evidence. Yes, Jesus drained the cup of God's wrath against the sin of his people to its very dregs. And without a doubt, this was the greatest and horrific, most horrific day of human or divine suffering in the entire history of the world. But does that mean that Jesus was separated from his Father? What is it in this anguish Jesus wanted us to understand as he cried out in dependence upon God to the one who was bringing his suffering? Well, as Jesus refers to Psalm 22, we should have a look at Psalm 22. Why don't you go there yourself? I think we've got time. We might squeeze this in. Keep a finger in Matthew 27. Flick back to Psalm 22. It's a longish psalm, but just skim through and see if you notice any details that sound like what we've just read about in Matthew 27. See if you can see why Jesus might be referring to this. You can have 45 seconds. Enjoy. All right, let's come back together. Hopefully you started to see some connections. Sorry, I don't think I've quite got time to hear them all, but let's run through a few of them quickly. From the start, you might have noticed it's a Psalm of David, the King of Israel, the one whom God promised to send the Christ, the Eternal King. In verses 7 and 8, we read in the psalm, "All who see me mock me as they did to Jesus. They make mouths at me. They even wag their heads," as it says in Matthew 27. There's the mockery. "He trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for he delights in him." We've heard these words before, haven't we? Down in chapter verse 16, we're told they pierced Jesus' hands and feet, or the psalmist's hands and feet. It's what happened at the cross, isn't it? Then at the foot of the cross, they divided Jesus' garments among them. For his clothing, they cast lots. Things are being fulfilled all over the place, aren't they? Jesus' cry on the cross, as you read through the psalm, it reminds us that everything is being fulfilled just as God had promised. And that means as you read the whole psalm, that it seems Jesus had complete confidence that things would continue to take place just as God had promised. That his cry would be heard, that he would be delivered from death, that he'd be saved from the grave. And as a result of what God accomplished on the cross, as we read from the end of Psalm 22, it seems that Jesus had an expectation that all the ends of the earth would remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations shall worship before you, for kingship belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations. It should be told of the Lord to the coming generations. They should come and proclaim his righteousness to a people yet unborn, that he has done it. On the cross, Jesus, rather than seeming to say that somehow God has abandoned him, he expresses his dependence upon God in the hour of his greatest affliction. The suffering is just as God foretold, but so will the deliverance and the victory. And we will see that on the third day if you come back next week. Maybe you also had questions about some of the details about the dead being raised in verse 51. I don't think we've got time to look at that, but you can work that out together. It's actually verse 52. Now, maybe just briefly, it seems that as Jesus dies for the sin of his people, the shackles of death have been broken. The curse of sin and death has been taken away. And so in response, it seems that some of the saints in Jerusalem, they can't stay dead, that they leap from the graves as kind of an appetizer, a foretaste of the great resurrection that Jesus is bringing in. But they're just the support act. So they wait in their tombs until the third day when Jesus himself is raised. Spoiler alert, Matthew gives it to us there. But when Jesus is raised, they too come into Jerusalem and are witnessed by many of them as proof that the resurrection age has begun, that sins have been forgiven, that death has been defeated. But I'm sure you can talk more about that and ask more questions about that later. So what do we do with all this? Matthew's given us this smorgasbord of proof, of evidence, of great truths. We're at point four now. How do we respond? Identified with the crucified. You see, as Jesus is condemned and paraded to the cross, he's all alone. And the disciples have left. Simon Peter said that he'd stay with him to the end, and yet he's nowhere to be seen. Instead, some other Simon of Cyrene, is dragged in to help. But it's only after Jesus breathes his last that we're told of some faithful followers who are watching. There's women standing far off. Among the women, we're told there's the mother of James and John, two of Jesus' disciples, the sons of Zebedee. Do you remember where we last met her? It was back in chapter 20, just after Jesus said he must go and die. And what was her request? "Jesus, can my son sit at your right and your left when you come?" And she looked on to see the rebels crucified on his right and his left. I wonder whether she really wanted her sons to identify with this crucified man. It would all turn on how she understood those events, wouldn't it? Was this the fulfillment of all that Jesus had said, or the failure? When Joseph arrives in verse 57, it's the first time we've heard about him. He's a new character turning up on the scene. And it's the first time since Jesus' arrest that anyone has publicly identified as being with him. He goes to Pilate. He asks for the body. Like the woman who anointed Jesus just before his death, Joseph has an extravagant act. It's his own private tomb, the one that he had cut in the rock for himself, for his family. And he gives it to Jesus as he lays his body there. No one else had laid there until Jesus' lifeless body was put to rest. He closes the tomb, and leaves, but the woman is still watching opposite. And the next day is the Sabbath. He had to get the burial done before sunset. The religious leaders seem less bothered by the Sabbath, as we keep on reading in verse 62. They rock up to Pilate, asking to set a guard over the tomb. They want to work to make it secure, lest anyone suggest that Jesus has been raised. Somehow they have this expectation that people have, well, heard or spread that Jesus would not be held down by death. And they want to do all they can to squash that misunderstanding. As we look at these different responses, there's some pictures of how we too can respond to Jesus. Like Joseph, we could publicly come and identify ourselves with Jesus, with the crucified king. We don't know what Joseph understood, but he was willing to come and put himself with Jesus, whatever suffering may come with that. And through Matthew's account, we know so much more. Jesus is one who died just as he said, crowned as the king, the one who came to save his people, God's own son, bringing forgiveness, bringing hope, bringing life. We have all the more reason to come and stand publicly, unashamedly, with Jesus, the one who was crucified for us. But then there's also the response of those religious leaders. Ironically, they're blind to the truth that they should be teaching. They're fulfilling the scriptures that condemn them. They're the ones destroying the temple they claim to honor. In the name of, I don't know, enlightenment or religion, they deny and they suppress the truth. The blood that was shed that was all about the covenant for the forgiveness of sins, they say, let it be upon us and on our children, blood that condemned them for shedding innocent blood. They are a tragic picture of stubborn and rebellion, and a warning that we shouldn't silence and run from the truth or deny the significance of Jesus' death in the same way. And then there are the faithful women, stood by Jesus to the very end. We don't know if anyone really noticed them, standing at a distance. We're not sure what they were thinking, but they were there when others had left. Matthew wants us to see that Jesus truly died. He wants us to see the significance of that death so that we would respond firstly rightly to him, a bit like Joseph did, and then we would stick with him through thick and thin like the women did. And so at all costs, we would not be like the religious rulers who put him to death, who denied the truth, who rejected God. From all that Matthew has shown us, how will you respond to your servant king? Let us pray. Heavenly Father, thank you that you reveal the truth through all the events that took place then and that have been preserved for us now. Father, may we rightly come to Jesus, eager to be identified with him, keen to serve him with our lives, standing by him to the bitter end. Father, for those of us who may be feeling that Jesus is one who is not who he claims to be, open our eyes to the truth that we may find life and hope in him. And we ask this for Jesus' sake. Amen.
Thanks for tuning in to the Campus Bible Study podcast this week. Please make sure you are subscribed on your regular podcasting app. You can get in contact with us at campusbiblestudy.org. There, you can also find details about upcoming events and information about partnering with our ministry, both prayerfully and financially.